is in this picture.
Right. Great. Oh, thank you very much, Bob. Lars gave me this topic, and at first I wasn't sure what it meant, so I asked a bunch of people, and they told me, well, you know, I should address the observational confidence in 1As as cosmological tools, or evaluate in detail, you know, Wolfgang's models and all that, which I'm not competent to do. So I'm not going to do that. I think we do have observational confidence that we can use these things as cosmological tools. We may not yet understand what exactly leads to the luminosity decline rate relationship, but in any, and we certainly need to know more about the progenitors and explosion mechanisms if we want to get down to measuring the equation of state parameter down to a percent or so. But I'm not going to talk about that, Lars. So I'm going to talk more about just the explosion physics and all that kind of stuff, and whether the models agree with anything that we have. So again, as with the other morning speakers, Ken, where are you? Where did Ken go? Oh, there he's right there. I'm an observer. I couldn't find the nearest type 1A supernova here. Actually, the second nearest. Bob's the nearest. I believe your birthday was actually in December, right? So we can call this a delayed detonation or something like that, you know. So, and I, too, am growing older and forgot, as Wolfgang did, my gift. It is one of these little gizmos where you have a ball with a little stick sticking out, and there are other little balls on it. And if you drop it, they get launched to a very high speed. But I will mail it to you, Ken. Yes. Okay. So let me just start here. What do I think we really know? Well, I think we know that 1As have white dwarf progenitors. I think we know that they are thermonuclear runaways. I think we know that they're powered by the decay of nickel 56 to cobalt to iron. And I think we know that they are in binary systems. We really don't know of any other way to trigger the instability. What do we probably know? They're almost certainly CO white dwarfs. Okay, maybe I should have put this into the what we know category, because these don't work. I guess this morning I asked a question about this one just out of curiosity, and at first I thought it might work, and that's why I had this in the probably no category. But anyway, I think they're CO white dwarfs. They're probably Chandra mass from the uniformity of the spectra and the light curves, but as I'll say in a minute, you know, some of them might be superchandra or subchandra. And we know the basic explosion mechanism, I think. It's some sort of a combination of deflagration and detonation. But as we'll hear more in the rest of this conference, the details are hotly debated. And in particular, let me steal something from Fritz Ripke. Friedel already mentioned this, that W7 refers to road signs as well. So here are a few road signs linking a theorist with an observer. Here are the various theoretical details that will be discussed by pundits in this field here at this meeting. Anyway, I didn't know that W7 are road signs until Fritz came to Berkeley and gave a talk a few months ago. But anyway, here are all these details that I'm not competent to discuss, but those others here will. So, and then what do we not know? Okay, these details. I think there's still a lot of controversy about what exactly is going on in a 1A. I think it's possible that some of these things are superchandra and subchandra. We just are not certain yet. Stan wrote me a message the other day saying they're all 1.38 solar mass white dwarfs. Well, Stan, maybe most of them are, but maybe a few aren't. You know, so I think we should be open to that possibility. And we still don't know exactly what effect rotation has. We really don't know what the progenitors are, and this has been highlighted a number of times in this meeting. 1.39. Okay. Well, it depends on you know, mu. So anyway, and we don't know why the luminosity depends on the stellar population. Is it the ignition density? Is it something to do with the metallicity, mass, rotation, whatever? And then there are weirdos, and you know, 2002 CX variety will be the one that I'll highlight near the end of this talk. So let me start with the subchandra masses. I mean, I think Bruno Leibengut gave a very nice talk earlier this week on Monday, where he showed pretty convincingly, although with simplistic models, that some of these things produce very little nickel and not much total ejected mass, maybe half of a chandra mass or so. And so I'm really worried about this. I think this is a significant thing. We may say that some of the mass is hiding. We haven't taken it all into account, but maybe the observations and the primitive analysis that's been done really is telling us that some of these things, the low luminosity guys, are subchandra. That would be very interesting, I think. If you insist that they're a chandra mass, then maybe only part of it got ejected and there's some sort of a compact remnant left behind. Maybe only half of the star got ejected away. But I think these are things we really need to consider some more, some of these edge-lit outward explosions. Let me go on to the Superchandra thing. I just noticed that Andy Howell will be giving a talk on this on Thursday. He has a question mark, I think, in his title. Is this object really Superchandra? Do you still think it is, Andy? Okay, well, all right. Lars gave us all these titles with which we feel uncomfortable, but anyway. So let me just summarize very, very quickly, because I know Andy, I guess, will be talking about this more, but here are the before and after pictures of this wonderful SNLS supernova at redshift of a quarter or so, and it looked pretty normal, okay? You can see most of the usual lines, the silicon, the sulfur, and all that. Interestingly, they identify a carbon line here, so there's some unburned material in this star that's relevant for increasing what you think is the total mass. But somewhat unusual is the fact that the expansion velocities were pretty low for this thing. In fact, lower than those of most 1As, but not lower than the 2002 CX variety. But in any case, this is really very low. Okay, so if you look at the brightness and the speeds, it's 2.2 times more luminous than typical type 1A supernovae. There it is, way over here. Okay, and here's the typical distribution that's understood, quote unquote, with the Phillips relation. And here's its ejection velocities near maximum, which is really, again, at the very low end here. And so that's really very interesting because this factor in luminosity alone already brings you, according to Arnett's rule, to something like 1.3 solar masses of nickel. And then we do see silicon and sulfur and all those guys, plus some unburned materials, some carbon and oxygen. So they conclude that this thing could be really quite massive as two solar masses. And this is bolstered by the argument that if it were only a Chandra mass and the whole thing burned up, you would have extremely high ejection velocities. And yet, in fact, if anything, this thing has very low ejection velocities. So there's got to be a sink for the kinetic energy somehow, and that also suggests the higher mass. So I'm very intrigued by this object. I think it was a really great thing to discover. It's a wonderful object. You know, if it is a Superchandra mass, is it a single degenerate of some sort, maybe rotating very quickly, maybe with some sort of magnetic fields? I think modelers are beginning to go in these directions, but we need a lot more work in this area. Is it a double degenerate? Well, if so, how do you avoid the formation of an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf and the collapse of it through electron capture? And then finally, why don't we see more of these guys? Why don't we see essentially a continuum of luminosities at this high end? Why is this guy so weird and we have not seen many others? If this one was two solar masses, where are the 1.6 solar mass guys? You know, where are the 1.8 solar mass guys? So I think this is a very intriguing object that we really need to pay attention to. But I think this object clearly suggests that not all 1As are exactly Chandra mass white dwarfs. Okay, my second topic is the business of hydrogen. I think this is really very, very important that we need to really pay attention to it. There's really no sign of hydrogen or helium at early times or late times. At early times, you do expect to see some hydrogen in the vicinity of the supernova because you get a lot of free emission from the reverse shocked ejecta and photospheric emission as well, especially inverse Compton scattered photospheric emission. And you can go back to early papers by Franson and Chevalier and others on this. And so basically, the circumstellar material should be ionized, and we should see it. At early times, a number of people have looked for signs of hydrogen and helium. And this is from Peter Lundquist's KITP talk from a couple of months ago, I guess. And here, people are searching for H-alpha at early times using pretty high-resolution spectra. ESO has had a major program in this direction. And they just don't see any. And here, they're looking for helium-246-86, and they don't see anything. You might think maybe that's something. That could also be a noise spike, too. And helium-158-76, they don't see anything. So for this one object, they set a limit of around 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year for a wind velocity of 10 kilometers per second. Here are more of them. This is kind of hard to read. But, you know, here are regions around H-alpha, pretty good spectra, nothing seen. They look near helium-1, nothing seen. Near helium-2, nothing seen. These are all upper limits. With, here are the measured flux upper limits, and then The typical mass loss rates are, again, 10 to the minus 5, approaching 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. That's getting pretty small. So at early times, I conclude no one's seen any hydrogen or helium. What about at late times? Well, if you look at the Marietta models, and this follows along a long history of people working on this subject, some of the material in the envelope of the star should be entrained by the ejecta. And, the ejecta pass up this stuff, and so the hydrogen gets stuck deep inside. But when the spectrum, when the gas turns nebular, and you see all the way through it, you should be able to see this hydrogen in principle. So this is from the Marietta paper for different kinds of type 1a progenitors and a few things that would not be 1as because these are not Roche-Flob filling systems, but this is just shown to illustrate that if you increase the separation between the donor star and the white dwarf, you really get very, very small amounts of hydrogen. But for any reasonable things where you have Roche-Flob overflow or a win from a symbiotic type companion, you expect quite a lot of hydrogen, all right? So again, the ESO group has been doing this, and here's O1EL. Here's a late time spectrum about a year after maximum. This is the model with 0.05 solar masses of hydrogen, and that little bump is 0.01 solar masses. So they set a 3 sigma upper limit of something like 0.03 solar masses of hydrogen. Here's another one, 2000 CX, again 0.05, 0.01. And you see there's nothing much there, okay? Here's another one, 98 BU, 0.05, 0.01, nothing much there. And then more recently, Doug Leonard has been doing this devoting a lot of time to this on both Keck and Gemini. He studied two supernovae in some detail, and he presented this in Aspen a few weeks ago. And he shows a curve with 0.03 solar masses of hydrogen, and you see there's just nothing there at about the 0.01 solar mass level. Here's another one. 0.03 solar masses would produce this kind of a bump, barring details of radiative transfer. Okay, this is assuming you see all this stuff, and there's just nothing there. So here are the limits he comes up with, and they're all much smaller than the predictions, okay? See that? They're much smaller than the predictions. And he concludes that, well, if you had a really wide binary with a symbiotic type companion, this would go way down, and you might be able to be compatible with the observed limits. But all the Roche-Loeb filling donors just don't work. So with a wide binary and a wind dumping stuff onto the white dwarf, you wouldn't have as much hydrogen entrained in the ejecta. But, of course, these wide symbiotics are the one kind of progenitor that the radio observations strongly argue against. Indeed, Nino Panagia in Aspen said that the radio observations very clearly rule out only the symbiotic model. All right, here's a table, again from Lundquist's talk here at KITP, of several dozen type 1a supernovae that have been observed with the VLA, and they come up with m dot of 10 to the minus 6, a few times 10 to the minus 7, that kind of stuff. These are the most restrictive limits we know. And so that pretty much rules out the symbiotics. So this is a real tough issue. Now, maybe we're not seeing the hydrogen. Maybe it is entrained in the ejecta and we're just not seeing it because it's behind this iron curtain and scattering through resonance lines of iron 2 destroys the hydrogen photons that are trying to get out of these ejecta. So in other words, in a sense, in the hydrogen line, the thing isn't nebular. And Cecilia Cosma has mentioned this, although she was a co-author on the Matila paper that talks about how restrictive a limit 2001EL gives. So, but if this is true, if we're just not seeing the hydrogen, it really is there, then I'm bummed because it means we can't fully test the singlet degenerate models with these kinds of observations because the hydrogen is hidden. So that would be really too bad, because observers are trying hard to find this stuff. But in any case, I think this lack of hydrogen is a very, very serious issue, very serious, for any of the single degenerate scenarios. Either the hydrogen is hiding behind the iron curtain, or it is not there. Now, some people say there are 1As with hydrogen, lots of hydrogen, 1 to 6 solar masses of hydrogen, they say. And this is this new class, sometimes called the type 2As. I don't like that terminology. I'm sorry, Ken. I just don't like it. But anyway, nothing against you.
His birthday.
Yeah, I know. We'll accept hypernovae for today as well. Okay, so anyway, there's the 2002 IC class, of which now there's another one. And, you know, they've been interpreted as post-AGB ejecta interaction with post-AGB companion. You know, but I say, well, then why do we see either no hydrogen, as I just argued, or many solar masses of hydrogen? I just don't buy it. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me really uncomfortable. And if you do say that these are 1As, okay, by the way, this isn't only an argument for single degenerates. Livio and Rees argue that this could also be explained by a merging pair of white dwarfs inside a massive envelope. But in any case, I want to address this question whether these really are 1As. I think people have just jumped on this, and it was a very interesting paper, the Amui paper, and these are very interesting objects, but they make me really, really, really uncomfortable. And they made Stefano Benetti uncomfortable as well, and he, having more time than I have, I guess, actually went and started comparing spectra, and he has this very interesting paper that came out last December. Okay, he compares the spectra of O2IC with other kinds of objects, in particular some type 1Cs, and not just any old 1C. The 1Cs are a varied bunch, and if you compare them with 2004 AW, the comparison is about as good as that with a type 1A. Okay, so let me show you some diagrams. First of all, here's the light curve. Everyone knows about this rapid decline, and then just as the interaction started, the thing got bright again. Okay, fine. You can get that regardless of whether you have a 1A ejecta interacting with this interstellar or circumstellar material, or whether you have 1C interacting with the circumstellar material. So the light curve itself does not argue one way or another. Notice, however, that there are type 1C light curves, O4AW, that mimic type 1A light curves. And then there's just this interaction. Okay, fine. Now let's look at the spectra. This is where the action comes in. Okay, the spectra that have been compared, for example, in the Amui paper, are with type 1As. It's well acknowledged that normal type 1As, like 94D, do not show a good resemblance to O2IC. I mean, maybe they do, but highly diluted. But you get a better resemblance if you compare the 91T-like objects. Here's 97BR. And I will admit, this is quite a nice comparison. Looks pretty similar. Okay? But let's consider some 1Cs, Stefano Benetti said. Okay, 94I doesn't work well at all. Fine. But 2004 AW, which in fact was originally classified as a 1A, but only later when it started evolving, and especially when it became nebular, did we see that it was a 1C. The agreement is pretty good. Now, it's not so great right here, but there are other 1Cs that might not show these kinds of features as strongly. But out here, it's about as good as with the 1As. Now, that's near maximum. At 1 month past maximum, I would say the agreement with 1Cs, 10 minutes left, you are correct, Bob. Yes, thank you. The agreement with 1Cs is better, I would say, than with 1As, or at least the agreement with some 1Cs. Okay, so here's an agreement. Here's the comparison with 97BR. It's not a bad fit. I'm not saying that the 1As are impossible. But the 1C, O4AW, produces just as good a fit right here. And dang it, we don't have the spectrum here. That's too bad. It would be very interesting to see what the oxygen and calcium are doing. But on the other hand, oxygen and calcium are strong in 1As at that time, too. So probably this is not crucially missing information. But anyway, look at that. That's a pretty good match as well. It really is. So I am not at all convinced that these things are 1As going off in a hydrogen-rich medium. As you let the thing age some more, 1As have this huge iron complex there. 1Cs, especially the energetic ones, like the hypernovae, in honor of Ken, like 98BW, well, they have a big thing here as well, but they also have these. And if you look at O2IC, it basically looks like a broadened one of these things with hydrogen from a strong interaction. So this very late time spectrum, I would say, favors or at least argues as well for a 1C as it does for a 1A. So my bottom line, or and by the way, and Benetti is developing similar arguments for 05GJ, which whose early time spectrum didn't even show the sulfur doublet, and it didn't show much silicon. It really didn't look like a 1A. It looked like a featureless core collapse object, okay? And he's got that in preparation. I was just corresponding with him. So I actually think that the odds are higher than 50-50 that these are actually core collapse supernovae whose ejecta are interacting with circumstellar material. And there's been, I think, a bit of a supernova 1A bandwagon. People did not do their homework like Benetti did and sit down and really take a whole library of spectra and compare them with what was seen and see whether 1As really are the only good fit. 1As are a pretty good fit, but there are other things that are a good fit as well. I don't think the case is closed, and I wouldn't be surprised if these things ended up being core collapse supernovae interacting with their ejecta. Now, I'll be interested to see what Alicia says on Friday, because I just noticed that her topic is 1As interacting with their circumstellar material. Okay, so my single degenerate summary is that there are several possible paths based on what we heard this earlier this week. There may not be enough supersoft sources, and it's not clear that there are enough candidates if you require everything to be at the Chandra limit. If you don't require everything to be at the Chandra limit, things look more promising in terms of the rates, but theorists don't like them. The missing H is a big problem, in my opinion. Okay, double degenerates, I don't want to say much about this, except that I came to this meeting quite skeptical about the double degenerates, but I was mightily impressed by the searches that have been made. And something I did not fully appreciate before coming to this meeting is how small a volume has been searched for double degenerates. And Ed made a very good point yesterday that we do see double neutron stars in our galaxy. The white dwarf double degenerate pairs would be very faint. You only see a small volume. It could well be we have simply not searched out far enough, but these things should exist, and so I think a very reasonable path for some, if not many, of the 1As, given the problems with the single degenerate models, is that some might well be double degenerates. So there might really be two paths to the type 1A supernova, and there are hints of this even from the fact that some of these things are associated with old stellar populations, some with young stellar populations, and Weidong will talk about this a lot more, but we're about to publish our results this year of rates that are being determined of supernovae from our Lick Observatory supernova search by my graduate student Jesse Lehman, and I hope you meet him during this conference. He's over there in the corner right now. Not that he did anything bad, but he put himself in the corner there. But anyway, and confirming what other people have been finding the past few years, we see in our rates sort of the tardy component, the component that you see in old stellar populations, and then also a prompt component that nicely follows the core collapse supernova rate at some fraction, a third or a half or something like that. And so there's two populations of the type 1As. Okay, finally, in the last 5 minutes, diversity among 1As and correlations with environments. We've known for quite some time now about these two families of unusual 1As, the 91T-like objects and the 91BG-like objects. They are not the weirdos anymore. They used to be the weirdos 15 years ago, but they now are understood to some degree. They follow the Phillips relation. It seems like the 91T-like objects, for whatever reason, produce more nickel. They're hotter. They have a higher opacity. They have broader light curves. The 91BG-like objects have less nickel. They're cooler, smaller opacity, faster light curves. And Peter Nugent and company wrote a nice paper where they showed that a variation in photospheric temperature nicely reproduces at least the spectra of these objects. And people can tune the amount of nickel that's produced, and you naturally get the Phillips relation. So these are no longer the weird ones. But why are they found in different environments, young versus old stellar populations? How do the progenitors differ if we understand these type 1As as part of a well-defined sequence? Is it the density at the time of ignition, as was discussed yesterday? Is it that the more massive progenitors really are super Chandra, a la the SNLS object, the really extreme case? Does metallicity play a role? Does rotation play a role? These are all very open questions, I think. Finally, the real weirdos, and this will be discussed more by Mark Phillips, so it's okay that I only have 4 minutes for it. And also there's a poster by Stanishev on this, but 2002 CX broke all the rules. Now there are real weirdos that don't fit in any of these classification schemes. 2002 CX, in a paper by Weidong and gang, had basically normal B and V-like curves, but very weird R and I-like curves. And in the near-infrared, as I'm sure Mark will show, there was only one peak. In fact, I think I have a slide on that as well. They have a somewhat fast delta M15, but not like that of 91 BG. They're underluminous by quite a bit, yet their spectra, at least at early times, look like those of 91T. Here's a good case, 97BR has the iron three lines. There, another one. So O2CX, here it is. It looks like 91T at early times, but with low ejection velocities. So that's kind of weird, because 91T was, if anything, normal luminosity or perhaps slightly overluminous, not underluminous, and it had a very slow light curve. These guys have astonishingly small ejection velocities. At early times, 6,000 kilometers per second. For the calcium lines, the iron lines, all the lines have about the same ejection velocities. Throughout the evolution, we see about the same velocities for all the lines, suggesting a highly mixed set of ejecta. At late times, you have incredibly small velocities. 600 kilometers per second. This looks like noise. This isn't noise. These are all real lines. Here's a blow-up of them. Look at all those things. 700 or so kilometers per second, something like that. And again, nickel seen at early times, or at least iron seen at early times, iron seen at intermediate times, iron seen at late times, lots of iron all over the place. Very slow late-time photometric decay. Decayed only 3.5 magnitudes at day 300 versus 6 magnitudes. That suggests a lot of trapping of gamma rays. I mean, this thing does not make sense. It makes no sense. This is now a class. There's a bunch of them. Had this one been recognized, I mentioned an IU circular that looked weird, but I was too busy with 91T and 91BG to really pay much attention to 91BJ, but that was the third new class of supernovae, in a sense, arising that year. And Stanishev has pointed this one out. But anyway, these guys are all in spiral galaxies. They all have these very weird spectra. O5HK is a twin of O2CX. Mark will talk a lot more about it. At early times, the 91T-like spectrum. Chornock has written a paper about this. Sinow model shows all the normal elements. Lots of unburned, well, at least some unburned material, let's say, maybe not lots, but all the normal things, small photospheric ejection velocities, no second bump in the infrared light curves. That suggests a lot of mixing of nickel in the ejecta. Dan Kazin's models suggest that the presence of the absence of a secondary peak is very well correlated with thorough mixing of the nickel. So nickel is mixed all over the place. Everything is mixed all over the place. We see low velocity sodium and some other lines at late times. So there's intermediate mass elements and lighter things mixed down to very low velocities. This thing is thoroughly mixed. Thoroughly mixed. Very low polarization, maybe a feature at the iron three line. Anyway, thoroughly mixed. That suggests pure deflagrations. All right? But the pure deflagrations do have problems. By the way, here's a light curve model from Blinnikov, which is a pure deflagration. It fits pretty well. Here you can see some of the slow decline at late times, slower than normal guys. The problem with the pure deflagrations is, where's the oxygen hiding? You expect very strong O1 at late times. Maybe we're hiding it with very high densities. The calcium 2 to forbidden to permitted transition gives a density right now at late times of 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 particles per cubic centimeter. That's astonishing. This is 1 year after the explosion we're having these kinds of densities, if you believe these diagnostics. Iron gives also high densities, slightly lower. This is above the critical density of O1, which might mute the O1 line. Maybe that's how it's hiding, or maybe there's no O1 there. But how do you get these densities 1 year after the explosion? Deflagration and delayed detonation models give densities of 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 at this time. I have no idea what these objects are. There is no model that explains the O2CX-like class. The closest we've come is deflagrations, but we really don't know that they work. Maybe there's some sort of a oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf, but now I kind of don't think so. Explosion of a carbon-oxygen layer on top of it would give a fast light curve. Gamma rays wouldn't be trapped. So I don't really like that. Maybe it's some weird kind of a core collapse supernova, but then why, unlike in the 1Ds and 1Cs, is O1 absent? Why are the velocities low instead of high? We see as we go from the 2Bs to the 1Bs to the 1Cs that the velocities get higher because the kinetic energy per unit mass increases. If anything, this thing has low velocities. And why is the polarization low? All the core collapse stripped objects have high polarization. So I don't know. Anyway, there's a lot of work to be done. I don't have much observational confidence at all, except, Lars, that they are exploding white dwarfs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex. I don't think anybody slept through that one. Mark,
thank you.
Maybe you'd like to say
something. I like that. I'll take that as a compliment.
Oh, yes, that's a compliment.
With respect to the OTIC objects, I think a few of us did do some homework.
No, you did do some homework, but all I'm saying is that Benetti found 1Cs that look just as good as the 1As.
Okay,
I did not mean to insult anyone. Yeah.
Can I say something?
Sure, go ahead.
Just be calm.
Take a deep breath.
First of all, O2 is smaller than O4. So we didn't have any O4 AW objects to look at.
Okay? I will nod. I won't open my mouth.
You would have classified it as a 91T object back in O2. Now, secondly, even with O4 AW around, spectral categories are based on spectral classification. And 91T is a much better fit to the spectrum. I believe that's the case. I've asked my colleagues. I've asked people who work on the solar system. I show them the two spectra, and they all agree with me. Now, I'm not saying that it's a type 1A. I'm saying it looks like a type 1A. Where are the sulfur lines? So I think it would be really nice if these things were type 1Cs, then they'd go away. But I don't think it's that easy.
Okay, since Mark stopped talking, I'll respond. It is true that O4AW was not around then. I'm not faulting the Amui et al. Paper. The 1A fit was the best one you found at the time. It is now 2007, is all I'm saying. And we have more objects. We have better spectra. We have wider wavelength coverage. We don't have to be wedded forever to your original conclusions. So that's all I'm saying. Let us look at our spectral databases now. And maybe at early times, I admitted, this fit is better than that one. I came out and said that, whereas in the Benetti paper, it's just a little half-line sentence there. But at later times, it starts looking about as good for the 1Cs.
One more little comment. At late times, this is a big interaction with circumstellar material. You've got reverse shocks. You've got all sorts of things going on at late times.
Yeah.
So the fact that they don't match at late times doesn't bother me.
No, I know. But what does bother me is you have either zero hydrogen or tons of it. That really bothers me. And around 1Bs and 1Cs, we should have a lot of circumstellar material. So in a sense, this is the more natural conclusion. I don't know that it's right, but I'm very bothered by the all or nothing in the hydrogen and the 1As. It really, really bothers me. And this is a suggestive alternative explanation.
Okay, Alex, I have a question.
Where
and a
are
comment.
You? Oh, there you go. Oh, hey, Jean Jeannot, yeah.
The first question is about Doug Leonard's results. I'm not familiar with that work. Can you tell me how far away, how wide the symbiotic would have to be for the entrained hydrogen not to be a problem?
Yeah, pretty far away.
How far?
I don't know. The thing in his
table
is.
We have systems that
three,
have orbital periods of hundreds
of
years and decades. I'm wondering, is it those?
The thing in his table is three stellar radii. 3.16 A over
way,
R.
I mean, they're even
sure.
Small ones are several U.
Yeah. So, you know, So he says, of all these models, the only one that has the potential to make this number very small are the wide symbiotic binaries. That's why he concludes, this is a slide stolen from his Aspen talk, that wide symbiotics are the only possible single degenerate progenitor if you believe that hydrogen should be visible and is not hidden by radiative transfer effects.
Okay, I was just looking for that number. But the other thing I had was a comment based on the radio constraints, which is something I said earlier, which is you have to be a little careful, I think, using a direct comparison to type 2 supernovae and extrapolating what the radio results mean based on that, given that a symbiotic progenitor, for example, would have a different environment. If it had had recurrent novae, which most, a lot of these would, if you have a reasonable accretion rate, you're going to have swept out a cavity, and that's something you have to take into account. So the supernova 1A won't be exploding into the similar environment that a type 2 supernova is. It'll be exploding into a cavity. And I just think you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's true, but oops, I went the wrong way. But if you look at these, the panagia observations of 1As, they are taken at a, well, most are taken at early times. Yeah, maybe they give up too soon. That's a good point. But here's 1982E, which was done 4 years after the explosion, okay? Yeah, you know. So maybe we should tell Nino and Kurt Weill and others not to give up so soon if these things have a cavity.
They don't. So the other tables in the paper show much later limits. They just picked these because they're the earliest limits and they're the deepest.
Right.
And I was actually going to comment. In terms of the mass loss rates that they derive, you have to be very careful because they do assume that the absorption is dominated by free-free, like it would be in a type 2N. But we know that that's not the case for 1BC supernovae. So these are not the right mass loss rates to be using. I'm going to show on Friday the better one.
Which way it goes?
Well, higher or lower? Lower.
Wait, these upper limits become lower?
I can't. I'll have to show you on Friday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have to wait.
Stan.
You're wearing a red vest.
Since this is a session about things that annoy people.
me? Right, right.
Alex is not annoying at all. Super Chandrasekhar mass models are terribly annoying. And
I was here to annoy everyone today.
Yeah, the reason, one of them anyway, is it's not rotation that you're talking about, it's differential rotation.
Right.
You can only increase the white dwarf a hundredth of a solar mass or so by spinning it fast.
That's right. If you look at the Ewing-Langer
model, it has to sit there for 10 million years, you know, with whatever magnetic fields it generates with very extreme differential rotation. That's just theory. But
yeah.
Dan Kaysen and I also have Chandrasekhar mass models that are that bright.
Maybe anyone really want to say a word.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll really address this during... What's that? Tomorrow is my talk.
Okay.
So I'll address a lot more of that in my talk. But, okay, that wasn't really what I was going to comment on. But it's for this 2002 IC stuff, how do you have this... can theorists... And this is really a question for theorists. Can you get enough sulfur out of a core collapse to produce the sulfur that you see in the spectrum?
The sulfur W right there, saying.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the sulfur. This is something for theorists to talk about. But I remember many conversations with David Branch. David, correct me if I'm misquoting you, but we used to sit around over a beer or a Coke, and David would say he would expect a stronger silicon line in 1Bs and Cs simply from the solar abundance of silicon. Is that still your feeling, David? Yeah.
From a solar mass fraction of silicon, but the sulfur here really bothers me.
The sulfur does bother you?
I tend to be with Mark on this.
Well, yeah. If you look at 05GJ, it had I don't have the spectrum here, but it was essentially featureless at the time. It didn't have any of those things, neither silicon nor sulfur. You know, it looked like a regular 2N. GJ, 05GJ. Yeah, the interaction was stronger, but then you don't really have much evidence spectroscopically that you have a 1A
so
there.
I have the
it
mic.
It could have been anything inside.
So on that, are you referring to the 11-day after-explosion spectrum?
In the Aldering paper,
Aldering paper. So I'm sure the Sloan data is probably going to be better at those phases. But the We essentially dropped it at that point because we did think it was a type 2 head. One thing, a constructive thing to say about either of these is that the interaction is very strong, and so it's not just a hydrodynamic interaction. There's radiative coupling between this interaction region and the supernova ejecta, and that you can't just go around throwing, you know, sort of flat curves on top of supernova spectra and saying it's a good fit or it's a bad fit. It really has to be included in
sure,
some
none
kind of model.
Those models is very complete to my knowledge, right? And in the Aldering paper, they basically just added featureless or low-order polynomials to a 1A spectrum. And, you know, getting back to the sulfur and stuff, at this level in the 1Cs and stuff, you sometimes see little wiggles like this. I mean, there's no label here that necessarily says that this is definitively sulfur. I mean, and I don't know. I just think that it's an interesting possibility that we should consider more seriously and not just say we've proven these are 1As going off in giant hydrogen-rich environments. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Just my opinion about the lack of hydrogen and too much hydrogen. And the lack of hydrogen, we have to remember the companion of the recurrent novae, quite helium-rich.
Right.
Already, the hydrogen is very small. And also, the in Hachisu, the stripping of models, the companion star is losing lots of hydrogen by stripping off also.
Right.
So I think Marietta models just assume two naive models for that. So we have to be much more careful in recalculating. We need more calculation.
Well, point well taken. But people are also looking for evidence for circumstellar helium and have not found it either. I mean, these things appear, as far as I can tell, to explode in an empty region of space. That bothers me, you know.
Yeah, the too much hydrogen.
In the single degenerate model.
Regarding O2 IC,
Oh, IC, O2 IC?
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
If it collapses supernovae, then we have to produce 0.6 water mass of nickel in explosion like 98 BW, and so that means that quite a high energy, hypernova-like energy is required. And so can you see such features?
Well, again, the late time comparison with 98 BW isn't all that bad, I would say. Add a hydrogen thing here with because of the strong interaction, and broaden out these lines a little bit, and you've got a 98 BW spectrum.
But early phase is not like BW.
Well, I don't know. I want to sit down and take out a library of spectra, and not that Mark and gang didn't do their homework, but we now have many more spectra with which to do homework.
Well, six people very nicely addressed all my critical questions. So my positive question or solicitation of expertise is, do we learn about the normal type 1As that we use for cosmology and to some degree care about the most, or some of us do? Do we learn about those by studying the normal ones or the weird ones?
Oh, I think we learn from both. I think the weird ones are very good because if a weird one becomes definitively an example of a certain type of model, and we become extremely confident that that's what's producing the weird one, then in a sense that's not what's producing the normal ones. So for example, in the early days, the normal type 1As were thought to be complete, just pure deflagration models, and then it was found that there were all sorts of problems with that. The closest thing we, and I think Mark will echo what I've said, have come to for O2CX is the deflagration model, though it doesn't perfectly work. In fact, it has some real flaws as well. But to the degree that it does work, I think that helps convince me that the normal ones are not a pure deflagration. But I'll be even more convinced when we have a complete understanding of the weird ones. So I think that the weird ones are really a good thing to study. Yeah.
Okay, we have time for just one more. Akshat, go ahead.
Is a little green light on?
Now it's better.
Okay.
So as a final, it's an addition, maybe not a question. You were saying that we're not seeing the signatures of the single degenerate donor in hydrogen or helium, So we have a set of new results. I think they're not going to be mentioned here, so I'll take this opportunity. We see the signatures in absorption, actually, in sodium absorption, variable sodium absorption from the wind, from the single degenerate. So there are other options to look for these signatures of the
companion. You're saying you've seen a variable sodium absorption line, which you attribute to a circumstellar material.
Right. And this is work by Nando Patat. He's the lead author. And Phil, who's here, maybe can comment more later on.
Is it published?
It's submitted.
But not on AstroPH yet?
No.
Well, that's very interesting. I'll look forward to seeing that.
Excuse me?
Okay, good. We'll all be looking at AstroPH. I think that's about enough. It is normally the case that when people talk about ideas, they refer to how it affects their head or their thoughts. But here, apparently, the skin and the feeling is the thing that we use as a guide to the truth. I'm not sure whether this is entirely accurate, but I think that it does show us where there is friction, where there is irritation, where there are problems. And so it is a good place to focus.
That was my purpose.
Focus your effort. Thanks again, Alex. And now it's time for lunch.
Right.
All right. Do we have fun or do we not have fun?
Yeah, good.
We have plenty of fun. Thank you.